This is Colonel Sweeney, tape 3.
HMS Tiger was a modern cruiser, and it had very little spare room on it. Fortunately, during the July of that year, we had done an exercise on the east coast of Malaya with the commando carrier, which had carried a commando, and in HMS Tiger, my battalion had been carried. So we had had the good fortune to have some experience of allocating troops to various parts of the ship. There wasn't very much room. I was rather fortunate as the commanding officer in that I was allotted the captain's day cabin because he went up to his sea cabin. But otherwise, troops were sleeping in corridors, they were sleeping in the wardroom. Two companies, in fact, were out on the open deck with a screen over the top of them to keep the rain off if the rain did come. But somehow or other, we managed to fit about 600 soldiers onto that cruiser. Now, what happened was that during the day, I got this briefing from GHQ, which, as I say, gave me a lot of background information, but very little information about what was happening on the ground. And it wasn't like a staff college exercise, where when you take up the exercise, you know exactly where the enemy are. There might be one or two vague points, but you have a fairly good idea of what the opposition is. In this case, I didn't know very much about it, except that there had been trouble in Brunei, and we were to land somewhere on the north coast of Borneo and Sarawak. We didn't know exactly where. I met the captain. HMS Tiger had been off to Perth, attending the Perth Commonwealth Games, and was on its way back to spend a day in Singapore and then go to Hong Kong for Christmas. So the crew and the captain were rather disappointed to learn that they had now to take a battalion to an operational area. Moreover, the captain's wife had driven out over India with a friend in a Land Rover and had arrived only a few days before, was staying with the local admiral, and had met him for the first time in a long time that morning. And they'd clearly been celebrating and enjoying themselves because he was in a state of euphoria, because I remember that we walked up to the bridge as my green jacket troops in their green berets with their big green packs on their back were coming up the gangway. A rope sling was hauling ammunition over the side and plonking it wherever it could. Some Land Rovers were being hauled over the side, and because we were taking with us a smaller armored car unit, armored cars were being hauled over the side. And he turned to me and he said, for God's sake, let's sail before we sink. Well, we sailed at midnight with this enormous load on board, and we set off across the South China Seas. The next day, I was told that we would probably be landing the following day, and we still didn't know where. So I got hold of the company commanders, and I said, well, we're not going to land without ammunition in our weapons, so break open the G1098 ammunition, which of course is a very serious thing to do. You don't break open your operational ammunition unless you're sure you're going to be using it. So they got the boxes up from below and began breaking up the ammunition and loading the belts of machine gun ammunition and putting bullets in the magazines and getting ready so that when we landed we'd be able to shoot. Along came the executive officer, who was horrified to find that on his sacred quarterdeck there were troops with loaded weapons, because in the Navy, as you know, there's a very strict rule that no one is allowed to carry loaded weapons. And in the old big battleships, you always had Marines who guarded one part of the ship from the other part of the ship. However, after a very fierce argument, I said, well, I simply refuse to land the following day without my troops being properly equipped. So we got away with that. That night, I got a signal from GHQ which said, you are to land at Miri. Your left flank is the River Barham. You have no right flank. So that meant that all the way down to Kuching in Sarawak, there was no flank. And that was about all the information I had, but I was to liaise with the local authorities and carry out whatever operations were required. But one company was to stay in the ship and go on to Brunei to give reinforcements there. So the next morning we came off the coast of Miri, which is a little town which has an oil refinery close to the oil fields of Syria. The oil is pumped out at Syria, was sent down to Miri to be refined, and tankers would come in and take it away from there. There was a jetty which stuck out about half a mile into the sea, and from the shore came three launches. One of them had the chief of police, one of them had the resident, who was the chief colonial administrator, it wasn't colonial now, but the old Rajabruk Sarawa administrator, and the other one had a Captain Gribble of the Shell Oil Company, who is the local man in charge of the refinery, who had been a Shell captain for many years. And I asked what the situation was, and they told me that the rebels had got into the town. They'd seized two police stations, one at a village called Bekanu, up a river, and another at a village called Nir, up another river, and had taken over them both. But other than that, they didn't really know, but they felt that the town was threatened. So I then said, well, how are we going to get ashore? Now, in order to get all this equipment onto HMS Tiger, we had offloaded everything except a couple of whalers, so we had no boats on board the cruiser to get us ashore, but they said they had some ex-service landing craft which they used for drilling up the rivers and off the coast, and they would bring two of them out, and that together with the launches would be able to ferry our troops ashore. So for the rest of the morning we did that. We finally got all the troops on shore except the one company that was going to remain and go on to Brunei. And I then went to see the police headquarters and try and find out what to do. Now I found the resident wasn't a tremendous amount of help. I found the chief of police wasn't very much help. He was more interested in getting back to a normal police time situation where he caught people breaking the traffic laws. But there was one man who wore the insignia of a major, an Englishman, who had the Iban patrol group, a sort of paramilitary jungle police who knew their way around the jungles, and Captain Gribble. And they said, well, you can go down the coast to the where the river empties into the sea, and then go up the river. But as the tide comes in, that road down the coast is not of any use. To go through the jungle will take you about 2 or 3 days. So we suggest that you put a company onto each of our landing craft, and one goes down, and when it comes to the point where the river joins the sea, the landing craft won't be able to go up very far up the river. They can then make their way up that way, but at least it'll save you about 10 miles of either walking down the beach or trying to walk through the jungle. So I put one company on one landing craft, and the other company under another landing craft. Each had two launches, and I gave them as much information as I could glean, and I kept the headquarter company behind, and we took over the running of the airfield, we took over the running of the radio station, we took over the protection of the police station, and we put the town into a state of defense. Before the troops left, just at the last moment, I heard that the commandos had gone up the Limbang River and had had quite severe casualties when, in a landing craft or some craft, they had tried to land and had been shot at by terrorists on the shore. So I was able to tell both company commanders, one was called David Mostyn and the other one was called Mark Pennell, that they had to be very careful, and as they approached these police stations where the enemy was supposed to be in possession, they must not just go up the river, but they must have some people on the shore. And off they went. Radio communication was established, and I went back to the police station to make sure that all was well, got in touch with my brigade headquarters in Brunei, and tried to get the ordinary administration going. That evening, one of the companies came, and I said there'd be radio silence. I would not call them so that their radios would be crackling as they were trying to make their way up the jungle. They would call me when they had achieved a successful outcome. That night, the company that went up to the near caves area reported that they had seized the police station and they had no, the enemy had run away, there were no casualties, and they're now in possession. But no news came from B Company, who had gone up to Bekanu, which is a bigger police station. I got rather worried, and so next morning I'm an RAF double Pioneer aircraft came in, and I asked them whether they would fly me over the area so I could have a look and see what was happening. And I got into this plane with a chap called Tom Harrison, who was the curator of the Kuching Museum and who had come up because his wife, who was also something of an archaeologist, was in the near caves, which were ancient caves, doing some exploratory investigation of some paintings or figures in these caves, and he was worried about her. So he flew with me in this aircraft, and we flew over Baikonur Station, and as I came over the station, I could see a terrorist on guard outside the police station with a weapon in his hand. As the RAF pilot came low to have a look, and I said, "There's a terrorist there," we suddenly zoomed up about a couple of thousand feet in a few minutes because he realized that the chap might take a pot shot at us. We then did another circle and we could see one of the launches in the river getting very close to the police station. But I had no communication with the company from the aircraft. We weren't as sophisticated as that. So I could only go back to the aerodrome from whence the airfield at Miri, from whence I'd flown, and report all this back to my headquarters. And the shell captain, again, this marvelous Captain Gribble, came to my help and he said, "I'll get you a shell helicopter from Syria, which will come and fly you down there so you can see for yourself what's happening." So we waited at the airfield. And we waited and waited. And then finally, the helicopter appeared. And out jumped the pilot and he said, "We're sorry we're late, but there'd been a bit of shooting in Syria when the Queen's Own Highlanders took this over, and we thought we might have got a few bullets which might have punctured the fuel line or something in the helicopter, but it looks all right, so jump aboard and we'll take you down to the area of the police station." We're having lowered my morale considerably by telling me of the vulnerability of the helicopter. So we went off down and we landed, and by this time, in fact, a message had come through from the company commander saying he'd seized the police station. So I landed at the police station. They'd had a very short battle. They'd killed six and the rest had run away, and they'd taken over the police station. They'd released the hostages. So I left him with a few instructions and then I flew back and reported all this to brigade headquarters. Now, the thing we were very worried about at that point, and I had a Gurkha brigadier who'd fought in Malaya for many years, was that having seized the initiative, we would then be faced with a long, drawn-out, desultory fighting in the jungle because all these people would retreat up to the headwaters of the rivers and we'd have to try and seek them out. So I was told that night that HMS Albion, which was on its way, would let me have its helicopters the next morning so that I could land the third company, which had gone to Brunei, which was being sent back to me, up in the headwaters. And they would then block the headwaters and they would come downstream and we would then hope that we would be able to corner the rebels. And this, in fact, did take place. The local lands and survey people were most helpful. They provided me with their photographs of the area. The helicopter pilots flew in the next morning. I got hold of the squadron commander and second in command. I said, "I want you to land here and there and there and there." I went in one helicopter. Tom Harrison went in another helicopter to be able to help the pilot. And these are Wessex-type helicopters. And we did a series of journeys, and we dropped off the rest of this company up at these areas, up the river. And all this time, the HMS Albion, which had appeared off the coast over on one side, was slowly steaming past. And so finally, we once went back to refuel on the ship. It was slowly going towards Brunei. And the last thing was that the helicopter pilot dropped me off and I waved goodbye. We were using the local football field of the local school. And off he went and joined HMS Albion just before it sailed out of sight. So in fact, its passage towards Brunei had only been slowed down a little bit. It was moving along while we got the use of this squadron of helicopters. And by, within, say, 3 or 4 days, 400 prisoners had come in, and that was the end of the rebellion in that area. and we shipped them all back off to Brunei. So effectively, that was the end of it. And I always thought that it was if we'd had some of these sophisticated means of transporting troops in and out in some of our other brushfire wars, we would stamp them out right at the very beginning. So that was successful, and we stayed on in Miri for about another month until just after Christmas, patrolling the area and generally keeping the troops in these two police stations to make sure that nothing would start up again. And then the whole of the battalion was moved to North Borneo, where I had my battalion headquarters at Jesselton. We had a company at a place called Lawas, a company over on the east coast of North Borneo called Sandakan, and another company up in the north called Kudat. And this was an area the size of Ireland. So it was rather like having your battalion headquarters in Dublin, a company up in Belfast, a company up in Galway, and then another company, say, down in Cork. I was given a light aircraft to try and keep in touch with them. And there we stayed for about 3 months until we were relieved by another battalion. We went back to Penang. And then after 4 months in Penang, we came back. By this time, there was desultory fighting against the Indonesians, mostly up on the border. The rebellion in Brunei itself had more or less been squashed. In fact, it had been squashed. But there was a little bit of activities coming down in the Kuching area. There was a bit of activity, and there was a lot of activity on the border with Indonesia. And we spent the next 4 months based in Syria with companies out in different areas patrolling the border, but we never really had any big clashes with the enemy. We had a few odd small patrols that meet up with the enemy, but it was one of these marvelous periods when the soldiers absolutely loved it, because they were in small groups scattered throughout these these villages were on stilts, long houses they called them, where they all lived together for security, and doing what we called a hearts and minds campaign. That is, I would go out and take with me my medical officer and stay up in a village, and he would look at the sick and pull out a few teeth and repair some septic sores and so on, and then we'd move on to the next village. And this was going on the whole time, just showing ourselves and by our presence ensuring that the rebels didn't have any sort of safe place in which they could gather again. And that went on for another 4 months until we finally sailed back in HMS Albion to Penang. And then I gave up my period of command, but the battalion came back 4 months later and did another tour under a chap called Colonel David House in the Kuching area. But apart from our initial assault, we really never had any severe clashes with the enemy, though these did take place down nearer in the Kuching area, where the frontier came much closer to the inhabited and civilized areas. I think the success of the Brunei and Borneo operations was largely due to our past experiences, because we had by this time built up sufficiently rapid intervention forces, and once we got them into the area, we had means of transporting them rapidly from one place to another. The helicopter was coming in a big way, and the commando carrier was there, and their helicopters were grounded and used by the infantry for moving around, and then we had the Air Force helicopters too, which were very helpful in carrying small loads. Intelligence was still poor. I remember talking to a chap called Roy Henry, who was the special branch officer in Kuching, and he said to me that he'd been reporting for many months that there was instability and unrest in both Kuching and in Brunei. And this had gone back to GHQ, but it had not been terribly well received, because at that time, you see, the political feeling was that they would bring about the Greater Malaysia, and they wanted to give independence not just to Malaya, but to Malaya, Singapore, Sarawak, North Borneo, and Brunei. And the political feeling was that we don't want any trouble. Therefore, they were ignoring it. But Roy Henry, who I think later became head of the police in Hong Kong, told me that he had been reporting it. And the intelligence on the ground, when we got there, wasn't very good. The resident was an old Sarawa Brook officer who told me how he'd been recruited in London as a 16-year-old. And Raja Brook usually recruited his officers on three particular qualities. One was they should come from the West Country, where he came from. Two was that they should be tall, because the inhabitant of Kuching was a small little Iban, and so he wanted tall people. And the third thing was that they should be able to hold their liquor. And he said he was taken to the Savoy by one of the Brook family and filled up with an enormous quantity of drink, and he managed to stagger away without losing his face. But once he got round the corner, he was hardly sick in the gutter of the back street. But this was told to me in joke. But however, he was one of the old school, and I don't think he was able very well to cope with this new sort of situation. The police chief, I don't think, was able to cope with it very well indeed. And if it hadn't been for the shell captain and the head of this paramilitary Iban patrol force, I would have been hard put to know what to do and where to go. So again, intelligence wasn't all that good at the beginning. Mind you, Tom Harrison came along and he was a great help, because he knew he'd been dropped in there by the special operations executive during the war. He had actually lived in a village up in the hills which was occupied by a tribe called the Calabits. So he knew the place backwards, and he was of great help. And after a few weeks, of course, the intelligence was getting better and better. But it was still not all that good. Now, the strange thing, I think, is that when you get on the ground in a jungle situation, although you've been transported there in HMS Tiger, although you've been landed by helicopter, although you've gone in a fast patrol boat, once you get into the jungle, you're on your own 2 feet. You've got nothing to help you. And what you carry on your back is all that you're going to carry with you. If you're a commanding officer or if you're the lowest rifleman, you've still got to carry on your back your means of comfort. You can't have a jeep trailing along with comforts in the back of it. And you, therefore, it is essential that the rifleman, everybody, including the rifleman, is trained to live and operate in the jungle. And really, the rifleman in the jungle is no different today to what he was 20 or 30 years ago. And the great lesson is that once you go into a Far Eastern situation, you must get your troops acclimatized to the jungle, and they must learn how to live and operate in the jungle. Now, this is probably where the Americans made the mistake in Vietnam. You see, they made too much use of their sophisticated helicopters. The troops would be living in a camp which had fans and ice water and a Coca-Cola machine, and then they would fly off into an area where the enemy were. They would do a fire and search operation, and they would come back out again. They didn't stay there. I think you've got to live on the same level as the enemy in the jungle. We had learned this in Malaya. We'd learned to deny the jungle to the enemy, and we did the same thing very successfully on the whole in Brunei and Borneo. When we first arrived in Brunei or in Miri, we were under the command of an ad hoc headquarters. Brigadier Jack Glennie, who had been a staff officer at GHQ, was given three or four star, grade two staff officers, and he commanded the show. So the first four battalions came under his command. After a short while, he was sent back to GHQ to take up his appointment there again. And the Gurkha Brigade Headquarters, 99 Brigade, under Brigadier Pat Patterson, was sent to relieve him. So you then got a full brigade headquarters. Not quite a full one, because it had to be bolstered up because it had been doing internal security in Singapore, but it was made into a full brigade headquarters. And we found ourselves operating under a Gurkha Brigade Headquarters. Now, the one thing about the Gurkhas was that they'd been operating in the jungle for many years now. They were, after all, ex-Indian Army troops, so although they came from the hills of Nepal, They were very used to operating in jungly conditions. Many of them had fought in Burma, and then they'd been in the Malayan emergency. And the Gurkha soldiers and NCOs and officers were first-class operators in the jungle. I got the impression that the build-up on the headquarters was perhaps more than was required, because it seemed to me in the first instance that the troops were able to operate with a very small headquarters. Then they got a brigade headquarters. Well, that was about the right level. But then in came this superior headquarters, which in fact was a divisional type headquarters, under a very tough but very well trained and understanding commander, General Walter Walker. And he got the organization going, but it gradually became necessary to have this big organization, because the conflagration began to spread all the way down into Kuching, until eventually you had a brigade headquarters at Kuching. I think you had another brigade headquarters somewhere down the coast. So in fact, there was a full divisional organization. But during the time I first got there, you had really quite a small number of troops on the ground, under the command of a brigade, under the command of a division, which perhaps in the first instance was hardly warranted, but in the long run, I suppose it became necessary. My battalion, from the time it arrived in Malaya, was under the command of the Gurkha Divisional Headquarters, which was commanded by Walter Walker. And he was an excellent commander who gave me the most tremendous support, and also showed by his experience that he was extremely knowledgeable about the jungle. We did an exercise called Trumpeter with the Commonwealth Brigade and a Gurkha Brigade pitted against one another in the summer of 1962, and I was the chief umpire, and I learned an enormous amount from reporting on the events and seeing how they operated, and flying into Walter Walker's headquarters each day and listening to him giving out his orders. So there's no doubt about it that the best jungle fighters at the time were the Gurkhas, and the Gurkha Divisional Headquarters was very much set up to cope with another emergency in Malaya or elsewhere. At the same time, there was always the feeling that the Gurkhas were thrusting themselves forward, because at the time, back in the Ministry of Defense, there was consideration being given to the possibility of reducing the Gurkhas. There are a lot of people who don't like the idea of mercenary troops serving in the British Army, and there's only so much money available, and the cake has got to be sliced up, and the more money that went to running the Gurkhas, the less there was for the British Army. So the Gurkhas were, to a certain extent, under threat. And I think that in some ways they saw the Brunei and Borneo confrontation as a godsend opportunity to ram home to the War Office the indispensability of the Gurkhas and their brilliance at conducting operations in Southeast Asia. And I would imagine that as a result of the Brunei and Borneo confrontation, the Gurkhas preserved more of their fighting forces than they might well have done. I think perhaps they might well have been reduced to practically nothing if it hadn't been for the tremendous ability which they showed in being able to cope with the confrontation in the jungles of Borneo and Brunei. Then all right? Is that? When I first joined the army, I suppose I had a boy's own paper attitude towards war and fighting. And I was in the army for 4 or 5 years before I went into action. And I had assumed that in your first assault and attack, you full of bravery and courage, you say, "Come on, lads," and you dash forward and assault the enemy, and the lads all come on with you. Well, my first opportunity to test this out was when, having trained for many months and having got everything well organized, and having landed from a glider at the river bridge on the River Orne, we actually got to within the last few yards when one literally found that one's mouth had dried up. And instead of this great stentorian shout of, "Come on, lads," and the lads all coming on, it was as much as you could do to raise a good enough shout to get them all to charge. The next thing that happened, of course, was that having got to the point where you race towards the enemy, who you know are 20 or 30 yards away and that they're going to open fire, the lads didn't necessarily all come on in one great group, but one or two of them came and one or two of them hung around. Now, this was with a very well-trained platoon which had done this operation time and time again in practice in the hedgerows and the fields of England. And it was a much slower business because there was a certain amount of coaxing, a certain amount of pushing and so on. And so there's no doubt about it that when you actually come up against the enemy, what you think you're going to do doesn't always happen. Now, I was a bit ashamed of myself, I think, to begin with, because I thought this wasn't very good, until I spoke to many of my colleagues and I found that they had had exactly the same experience. You're much more wary in warfare than ever you are on training. So you don't pull out your sword and wave it and say, "Come on, lads," and everybody goes. You become much more wary and you become much more cunning, I think. You're not going to race up and charge the enemy if you can sneak up around a hedgerow. I don't think that once you've overcome one particular element of fear, that you have, as it were, wiped it out of your system for all time, and you say, "That's it now, I've overcome fear, I'm finished." I found that in the subsequent operations in Normandy and then after the Rhine crossing in Germany, that some days your morale was up and you were prepared to take enormous chances, and you were in fact sometimes brave and foolhardy. On other occasions your morale was low and you just felt that this was going to be a